Insight Meditation Community of Denver. You're able to hear me okay? Good?
Yeah.
All right, then. So this evening, what we're doing is getting together for the fourth and final installment of our month-long series on Buddhist teachings on the foundation of mindfulness. So the first in the series was mindfulness of breathing in the body. And the second was mindfulness of the mind's innate tendency to seek out opportunity and avoid threat, likes and dislikes. The third one that we talked about last week has to do with being mindful of what in the discourses are called mental factors, but basically it's everything that's going on in the mind other than processing sensory input, thoughts and feelings for the most part, memories, plans, speculation, and then emotional states that arise and change and pass away, whether we judge them to be afflictive, like sorrow or sadness, anxiety, fear, depression, anger, or whether we judge them to be pleasant, you know, feelings of peacefulness, of openness, of calmness, kindness, joy, right? Not diving into the stories that are associated with the feelings, but just noting them when they arise and change and pass away. And also really paying attention to whether or not certain kinds of thoughts and certain kinds of emotions seem to be linked to one another, as if maybe one brings the other on. This is like the metaphor that I've been using in this series. It's like the first two foundations of mindfulness. It's as if we're going on some kind of a nature study field trip, and we've been gathering data about our internal ecology, the ecology of mind. And the fourth foundation is the one where we bring everything back to the lab for analysis, okay? So we look at everything that we've observed from the perspective or through the view of the offer that the Buddha made when he began to teach, which is, you know, I teach one thing and one thing only, suffering and the end of suffering. So how to look at everything, understand everything that the mind pulls in and uses to construct some reality view, right? How the mind does that in ways that can either lead to the perpetuation of suffering or its cessation. So looking at the experience through these various lenses, various kind of mechanisms, means of understanding of how the mind creates suffering and how it can likewise bring it to an end. So that's what we're going to do after we sit tonight. But in order to gather more data for the analytic phase, how about we do some sitting? So let's take just a moment and settle into our sitting posture, right? Whether you're sitting on your couch or a chair, maybe a bench or a cushion on the floor, it doesn't much matter, as long as the way you're sitting allows you to do two things. One is to sit with ease and in a relaxed way, so you feel centered, and calm, if you're not having to exert a lot of effort just to be in your posture. At the same time, doing so in a way, checking the posture to make sure that you stay awake and alert so that you're sitting up straight, you know, with your shoulders back and your head up, arms relaxed at your sides, and your hands may be folded in your lap or resting on your legs, and then allowing the eyes to gently close and the attention to come to rest on your breathing. Whether you notice this mostly as air moving in and out your nostrils, maybe the rising and falling of your abdomen. Maybe it's awareness of the expansion and contraction of the entire body. Okay. As each inhalation brings in fresh oxygen, things the body needs to stay healthy and alive. And then breathing out that which is no longer needed. You can use the little mantra, nourishing, cleansing, nourishing, cleansing. Okay. So the eyes gently closed, the attention coming to rest on the breath, wherever you notice it to be, whatever way it best presents itself to you. Not watching the breath from some external viewpoint, but being the breath. Being a breathing entity, being mindful of the breathing that your body is undertaking, that it does naturally and rhythmically on its own. Whether you're breathing a long breath or a short one, deep breath or a shallow one, rapid breath or a slow one. Simply experiencing the breathing as it is. As the mind-body process finds what natural pace and depth and rhythm is most comfortable and appropriate. Feeling the body breathing itself. Just as do all sentient beings. And teaching this material turned out to be kind of helpful. To provide context, one of the metaphors that is useful for me and looking at the teachings of the Buddha generally and the role of mindfulness within this greater context is, excuse me. Have you ever seen these, or have you ever seen one of these toys, a Russian toy? It's called like nesting babushka dolls, you know? One inside of another, inside of another, inside of another. So when the Buddha said, I teach one thing and one thing only, dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. Well, as we know, it turns out to be a little more complicated than that. So this holistic statement of his, you know, one thing and one thing only, dukkha and the cessation of dukkha. So you open that babushka and there's another one. It's like, oh yeah, well, cessation of suffering. There's actually four teachings around that, or, you know, the ennobling, the four ennobling truths. One is that dukkha, sometimes translated as suffering, not a great translation, probably, I'd say I tend more to use something like mental and spiritual distress as a closer approximation for that term and what he was probably trying to get at. So first, just the recognition of the fact that that kind of distress exists. because our tendency is to spend a lot of time and effort pretending that it doesn't. And so the first of these ennobling truths is just waking up from denial and acknowledging that distress exists. Second is the examination of what is the source of this distress. And the Buddha talked about different forms of suffering that we encounter in our lifetimes. The suffering that comes from just being in a physical body, physical affliction, aging, infirmity, and death. The kind of suffering that occurs as a result of us being social beings, things that happen in our social environment. The third form of dukkha is one that is actually self-generated, that the mind itself generates, and that the mind itself is capable of overcoming. And that's the form of dukkha that the Buddha aims his teaching at. So these others happen, you know, bodies, should have read the fine print before he took delivery, you know, the different parts break down at different times, warranties run out on this, that, or the other part. Some you can swap out, others, probably not. So the kind of dukkha that he, it's why I call it, you know, mental and spiritual distress, a form of suffering that actually originates with the functions of mind, and that it's actually possible to train the mind to no longer produce. And that form of suffering, the Buddha talked about, and the cause, the principal cause of it, is really, really wanting things to be different than they are. Okay. A craving and a clinging for that which you don't have, a strong aversion to that which you do have but don't want. And then a blocking out of all other aspects of existence. So identifies where it's coming from. Third ennobling truth, the fact that it's possible for the mind to train itself to stop creating that kind of dukkha. And the fourth of these ennobling truths is, of course, the means by which you go about training the mind to cease creating suffering for itself. Ta-da! Next babushka. You open that one, and voila, it's the Eightfold Path. Okay. So, looking at that one, you know, we use the Dharma wheel as a characterization of it. Okay. And there are what are called the wisdom factors, training the mind to be aware of, to recognize and to learn from insights into our karma, insights into our past, training the mind to be capable of recognizing insights into our future, the two wisdom factors, including insights into our intentions. Speaking and acting and living one's life in a way that brings about the cessation of suffering rather than the perpetuation of suffering. Okay. So I have the two wisdom factors, karmically related, insight into our past, insight into our future. We have the three fruition factors, right? Speech, action, and way of life. And then we have the meditative factors, the ones that have to do with creating conditions favorable in the mind for these insights to arise in the first place. So mindfulness is one of the three meditation factors, one of the three meditative factors. The other two are skillful effort and samadhi, sometimes usually translated as concentration, not a great translation, tranquil, focused, sustained attention is a much better way to understand that meditative factor of samadhi. When the mind is calm and clear, when the effort is not too strained and not too lax, then conditions are really favorable for mindfulness to occur, the third of the three meditative factors. And that's what this whole series is about. It's just, you know, it's like we've been focusing just on one spoke of the Dharma wheel, the Eightfold Path. And when we really get down in the weeds in terms of mindfulness meditation practice and learning to do it, the sense can arise that the whole purpose, you know, of this is to learn to do mindfulness meditation, you know, sort of the goal. And the Buddha said, well, no, that's not really true. Mindfulness meditation is a means to an end. It's not the end in and of itself. The goal, as the Buddha taught it, is to lead a mindful life, right? So mindfulness meditation is about training ourselves to lead a mindful life. That is that is where the freedom lies. The Buddha says when you really become capable of tuning in to everything that we do and say, okay, then it becomes more and more evident what the intentions are that underlie what we're about to do or say. The better we are at being able to look more and more deeply into our own past and to recognize insights about our past when they arise, the less likely we are in the future to think and say and do things that are going to create more suffering. So a pretty high level of mindfulness is necessary in order to be able to recognize those intentions when they arise. So that's why we do the practice. It's to make it possible for us to live in ways that where we don't keep replicating the forms of mental and spiritual distress that, you know, bring about the suffering in the first place. So the other metaphor that I've been relying upon, excuse me, is the one of being on kind of like an ecology field trip where we've been spending our time over these last 3 weeks learning how to take in through our sense apparatuses, okay, what it is that our existence consists of. How do we go about taking all the sensory input, including stuff coming up in the mind, and weaving a kind of a vision or an understanding of reality out of it. So we've been kind of looking at the raw data. In mindfulness of dharmas, the Buddha says, all right, now that we know how to experience the body as a body, the living body as a body, you know, the living, breathing body. to experience it internally. What does it feel like, right? To experience it in relationship to the environment around us, including other people. Once we have those abilities and just looking at the mind's ability to experience being in a body, looking at how the mind automatically judges all sensory input to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, threats, opportunities, irrelevancy. Once we have the ability just to look at what the mind is up to, insofar as the arising of thoughts and emotions is concerned, then it's time to apply frameworks of understanding that help us see how, on a step-by-step basis, the mind goes about creating the suffering that he is teaching how to bring to an end. That's what the fourth foundation is about. And I'm going to give kind of an overview of the way he unpacks this, the way he suggests thinking about, analyzing, understanding what's going on in terms of mental activity and how we go about creating our own reality. So in investigating the mindfulness of dharmas, first thing he suggests doing is have a closer look at what happens when you exert skillful effort to create, to allow for the cultivation, the development of samadhi. As you go about focusing on the breathing, calming the mind, seeking to make clear what's going on in the mind so that you can begin to create conditions favorable for the arising of insights into your past and future. So as you start to do that, something you'll begin to notice after a while is that there are kinds of mental activity that tend to get in the way, that tend to make concentration difficult. And he said, that's not just random activity. Those mental activities that arise are purposeful. And the purpose of various of these mental activities or disturbances is actually to prevent insight from arising. And he said it's real cause and effect. The more that you work on calming the mind, there is an aspect of mind that is trying actively to prevent that from occurring. It's like a defense mechanism of the self-constructed self, because once you begin to really have a calm mind or mindful moment to moment to moment what's going on in the mind, what begins to happen is penetrative insights into the nature of self. And the self is not very interested in having that happen. So he said, as soon as you really become more mindful, as the samadhi gets deeper, the natural reaction of the mind is to prevent or to try to impede deeper and deeper concentration from occurring. So this whole teaching of the Buddhas in the mindfulness of dhammas, the first teaching he offers is what are called the hindrances, or the obstacles to concentration. And again, these aren't random happenstance. You know, it's like after a forest fire, there's a mudslide. Kind of how it works. As the mind becomes more calm and clear, mindfulness gets stronger. The self tries to prevent the progress of mindfulness into insights, because the insights have to do with penetrative observation of the very nature of self and how the mind constructs self. And our sense of self is trying to prevent that from occurring. First way it does so is by creating disturbances in the mind. And the metaphor the Buddha uses is a still forest pool. And various kinds of things that are energies that rile up the still pool so that you can't see to the bottom, so that clear seeing into the nature of mind becomes possible. Most of the hindrances are emotional states, afflictive emotional states. One is anger, ill will, aversion. One side, the aversive energy in the mind is said to be like two sides of a coin. One is anger, the other is fear. Same root, essentially. It's just different responses to the same root. So, anger and aversion. It can be mild irritation, it can be rage, okay? So it can vary in intensity. But if the mind is really betaken with strong aversive feelings, especially expressed outward, right? Concentration is impossible because you're taken up with, you know, this angry state of mind. Second of the hindrances is, instead of being upset about perceived threats, okay, is the mind that is lost in craving and clinging. Instead of being angry at something that is present in your environment, it's craving something that's not. So craving, clinging, okay. When the mind is lost in that realm of energy, once again, concentration is impossible because the clinging fills the mind's eye. Third one is the Buddha likened this, the image that he uses, as if the still pool is overgrown with algae. So it's thick and green and sluggish and really incapable of supporting much life other than the algae itself. So a sense of dullness, of sleepiness, of the mind just like really stuck in the muck, right? Not capable of seeing much of anything that's going on around. Fourth of the hindrances, the anxiety and worry and restlessness. The other side of the aversive coin, okay. Anger is this outward directed aversion. The fourth hindrance is more, more inward directed, fearful. Worried that something unpleasant is about to happen. And the fifth of the hindrances is doubt. So it's the first four seem to be mostly about emotional states, whereas the hindrance of doubt seems to be sort of more intellectual. You know, it's thinking that maybe this isn't the right path, or this isn't the right teacher, or that you don't have what it takes to hack it, you know, doing this practice. But in fact, the Buddha said that's not entirely true. It's not just the rational mind at work. There's doubt. Yeah, maybe it's true, maybe it's not. Okay. That is, you know, you call that noble doubt, right? You got to check it out for yourself. There is an element of skepticism in this form of doubt, right? So there is an element of suspicion that maybe somebody's hosing you, you know, that not only is the stuff not true, but someone's trying to make you think something is true that isn't. So, I guess before I go any further, I wanted to ask, do any of those sound familiar to anybody? Have you by any chance ever experienced them when you're sitting? when you experience one of these hindrances, what do you find your natural tendency to be? Don't everyone speak at once now. Don't know about you, when one of these hindrances arises for me, my first response is aversion. You know, if I'm trying to be concentrated, really trying to get the mind clear, calm, peaceful, and that's not happening, then I tend to get perturbed or upset by any of these hindrances when they arise. And when that occurs, one of the things through long, sometimes painful experience is that hindrance is working. You recognize the anger, you recognize the craving and clinging, you recognize the sloth, you recognize the nervousness or the anxiety, you recognize the doubt, and then the mind's next thought is, oh, I don't want that to be here because it's keeping me from being calm and clear and peaceful, which is how I want to be. It's like the old adage, you can't get there from here. To feel aversion to any of the hindrances when they arise is to fuel them and feed them and make them stronger. And you know, I can do probably a whole series or at least a couple of teachings down the road here a little while where we dig into the hindrances with, you know, in a little more detail. But as long as you feel aversion to any of these hindrances when they arise, it's functioning effectively. It's functioning as it was designed to. What is the most skillful possible way, in most cases, to work with the aversions is to investigate one when it arises. So instead of experiencing what you deem to be unpleasant or something you don't want with aversion, if instead you can, interesting, what's arisen here? Why? You know, the anger or the craving or whichever of the other hindrances is arising. It's there for a purpose. What's it trying to do? What is it trying to keep me from seeing? How is it functioning as an obstacle to concentration? How is it keeping the mind from becoming clear? So it's like kind of doing judo on the hindrance, right? You use its own energy and you start working with it as a teacher. You know? So you investigate what the nature of that hindrance is. And as you find yourself able to do so, what you also realize that the mind is doing is disempowering. It's making it porous, it's weakening it, it's turning it into a simple object, you know, an object of mindfulness itself. You got to go through the door, you can't go around it. But it's a really important realm of teaching. And whenever the other tendency I think that we can have is that, you know, and even after, you know, 40 plus years of sitting, they still arise for me. But I've also got enough experience with them that I'm able to recognize them, inquire into their nature and why they arise. And so they don't get me quite the way they used to. But it really is possible to morph what seems like a powerful obstacle to concentration into a teaching about why concentration is difficult in that moment. And then once you train yourself to do that, then they don't tend to be quite such a problem anymore. In this unfolding, this unpacking of this teaching on mindfulness of dhammas, you know, we're just, you know, more and more little babushkas popping out. The next thing the Buddha says is that once you've gotten to the point where these hindrances lose their power, or they don't provide the obstacle that they used to, what the self really, really didn't want to have happen is what begins to happen, which is to say, you begin to, you start to have the ability to look into the mental activity that creates the self in the first place. So what begins to happen is the possibility of penetrating insights, not only into the nature of self, but also the nature of not self. And so in this mindfulness of dharmas, after the hindrances, the Buddha teaches about the aggregates. And this is a teaching about the literal process by which the mind goes about conjuring up a sense of self. What are the ingredients that go into self-creation? And how does the mind do this? You know, the five aggregates, you know, that which we call self, I say, is nothing more than the five aggregates affected by clinging. Okay. It's the teaching of the self rather than it being a permanent and abiding entity. And in the Buddhist time and in Brahmanism, a permanent and abiding entity that moves through various lifetimes, you know, until it achieves union with Brahma, you know, the mind of God, essentially. And the Buddha said, in my investigation, I don't think that that's true. I don't think there is a permanent abiding self. I think we make ourselves up literally through mental activity, through these elements, you know, through the body, through the judging of like, dislike, don't care, the function of perception by which we identify stimuli, the mental activities, thoughts and emotions, our consciousness of these things, that we, it's like kind of like how plants do photosynthesis. they pull together and create something, matter out of nothing. You know, out of water and minerals and chlorophyll. So it's a little like photosynthesis, the Buddha said. The mind actually conjures up something that didn't exist before. And he said, the self is present when you conjure the self up, and the self is absent when you don't. And once you begin to really take in that understanding, once you begin to see that maybe the Buddha is onto something, then the whole concept of self begins to soften and become malleable and become porous. And that is quite a milestone in terms of the study and the practice of Buddha Dharma. Because the mind has begun to entertain the possibility that there's nobody home, you know, that that which we call self is nothing more than a mental process, a form of mental activity. And that is, and the Buddha says also that that very function of mind is one of the causes of the very suffering that he promised doing this practice would be able to rid us of. So, you know, in the Buddha, in the second ennobling truth, when he talks about sources of suffering being craving and clinging, he said that there are four principal objects of clinging that are especially difficult for the self, the mind, to let go of. But letting go of them, you must, if freedom's to be discovered, is to be found. Okay. One is attachment to sense desires. You know, like all sentient beings, we're hardwired to seek opportunities, you know, to nourish ourselves, to protect our, you know, continue to propagate species. So gratification of sense desires, really hard one to let go of. We wouldn't be here as a species if we weren't good at seeking out opportunities and avoiding threats, right? But to the extent the mind becomes obsessed with doing that, then a sense of self is created around that. And until you can let go of an obsessive need to gratify sense desires far beyond what's necessary just to stay alive in the world, then freedom can't happen. So craving and clinging, the sense desires and their gratification. Craving and clinging to rites and rituals. And this is kind of a historical context. The Buddha was lived in the time when Brahmanism was kind of the state religion. And there is this belief that if you just did the right mantras and the right number of, you know, of certain kinds of rituals conducted in certain patterns, and you just kept that up, and of course supported the Brahman priests, then you might be able to achieve enlightenment by those means. But as I said, don't think so. What you're doing when you do that is that you're mistaking the means for the end. Okay, this idea that by just performing rites and rituals you're going to become free. Not so much. Clinging to views and opinions. In the Sense and Ming, the verses on the faith mind, there's a phrase in there that says, do not search for the truth, only cease to cherish opinion. That is holding on strongly to views and opinions, in fact, that makes it not possible for us to see what's real, what's true. And the fourth thing that's really hard to let go of, the Buddha said, is the notion of a permanent and abiding self. Okay. So these forms of clinging in particular, the Buddha said, lie at the very heart of the mind's generation of mental and spiritual distress. Okay. And freedom from those, the third ennobling truth, is letting go of those forms of clinging, right? And that's the means by which freedom ultimately occurs. Joseph Goldstein, one of my root teachers and a friend, a lot of years ago, wrote a book called One Dharma. And he wrote it because there are all these different forms of Buddha Dharma, Buddhism, coming to the West at the time, you know, from Japan and Korea, and from Tibet, and from Southeast Asia, okay, each with their own rites and rituals, each with their own language, each with their own way of teaching and understanding what it was that the Buddha had to say. And there is this proliferation of traditions here in the West. And what began to happen was the same kind of sectarian conflict that had been going on in Asia for the last 2,500 years, right? And he saw a real danger in that. So he said, maybe it's going to be kind of important for us to have a look, not at how all these Dharma traditions differ, but rather how they're alike, how they're the same. And so it's a lovely book. I use it in my own teaching and to help my own understanding quite a lot. And I remember he was being, or actually I was present for an interview that he gave about the book shortly after it came out. And the interview asked him, well, across all these different forms of Buddha Dharma, from all these different traditions, Mahayana, Theravada, Vajrayana, is there any one thing that across them all that they all hold in common? And he said, yes. There is no school of Buddhism that says claim. So ultimately it's all about letting go. And so the teaching on the aggregates, you know, how mind constructs self, right? Is core to understanding how the mind creates mental and spiritual distress. And the cessation of that, the third and only truth, the means by which the dukkha is dispelled and overcome is by letting go. Letting go of views and opinions, letting go of rites and rituals, letting go of clinging to sense desires, letting go of the notion of the permanent and abiding self. Doesn't mean not to have views and opinions, just means don't cling to them, right? Sense desires and their gratification are necessary to stay alive on earth, right? But don't get obsessed with them. Don't let them get out of hand. You know, once you've met basic needs, let it go. So that's, you know, and then the third truth, and then the fourth one, you know, we've just been talking about. But the real richness, and now, you know, once we've gotten past the hindrances of the Buddha's unpack, basically what he's doing is he's teaching the path to awakening and the mindfulness of dhammas, you know, just kind of spelling them out. So he's given this formula for self, how the mind creates self, how the mind cannot create self, which is where the liberation begins to occur. As that begins to happen, what qualities of mind begin to arise, what the Buddha called factors of enlightenment, mindfulness, curiosity or inquiry, energy, rapture, calmness, concentration, equanimity. That's the seven factors of enlightenment. That's in there in mindfulness of dhammas as well. So that fourth foundation of mindfulness, the one where we take all the data that we've gathered from the first three foundations and really study it carefully from the perspective of these teachings, is how we ultimately go about achieving freedom. So that's the essence of the fourth foundation. And I mean, it's a lot. And each of these whole books have been written about, you know, each aspect of those. But how about some questions, comments, reflections anyone might have about anything I've said here so far this evening? Please, Carol, and then Gloria.
Okay. You talk about studying the data. That sounds sort of academic.
Yeah.
It sounds sort of intellectual. Study it carefully. What does that mean? I mean, does that mean that you're supposed to think about what happened during a meditation period? Think about what you got wrapped up in or obsessed with? I mean, in a very rational kind of way? I mean, is that what you're
being an ex-academic, it's kind of a, kind of a occupational hazard, I guess. Thank you for pointing that out. I don't know. So here is an actual event, for instance, that happened. Let's say two people on a meditation retreat and sitting in the hall. It's in the summertime in the south. Out the windows are open. Outside, there are star jasmine plants growing up the pillars on the porch veranda of the meditation hall. Meditators are sitting inside. One person smells this lovely, sweet fragrance of the star jasmine and is transported back to a time in childhood. Child born to troubled parents, kind of having kind of a hard time. And this child would go out, this little boy would go out and sit on the porch swing in the veranda and just close his eyes and smell the jasmine and would be comforted. Okay. Could be reminded that it's a beautiful world, even though his parents were inside fighting. And so it has a really sweet, heart-opening connection associated with just that fragrance. So it was sensory input, okay, that triggered a memory, right? It triggered a memory of growing up in a troubled household, but it also triggered a memory of his mind's, even as a child, of his mind's ability to find comfort and calm and clarity in smelling that fragrance. Another person on the retreat, smelling the fragrance, remembers a time that she was walking home from the library on her college campus one evening, smelling that fragrance, was assaulted, dragged into some bushes, and sexually assaulted. Okay. Two people, same retreat center, same sitting, breathing in the same molecules of fragrance, and experiencing the smell in radically different ways. Okay. That the mind was construing self, was construing their reality in the moment in completely different ways because of the association with the fragrance. So it's just one example of how we take these sensory inputs and create an understanding of our reality based upon the same sensory input, but a completely different experience on both sides. So, and that's just one example. Fragrance, for whatever reason, has an incredible power to do that. It's associated either with pleasant or very unpleasant memories and the emotions they arise. So in that moment, for these two different meditators in the same hall who just heard the same Dharma teaching, doing the same Dharma practice, they're in that moment in time, they're inhabiting completely different realities. Because the mind has said, oh, this is who I am. This is the little kid who is able to persevere through growing up in a troubled household. And then the other person who said, wow, this is who I am. I had to endure something terrible, and I found the strength to live through it and to make my peace with it. Okay. So, yeah, looking back, I was kind of dry the way I was trying to explain what's going on. But essentially, we take in all this stuff, you know, and we can construe completely different realities out of it based on our own karma, based on things that happened to us in the past and how we responded to whatever it was that happened to us in the past. Okay, so when we look at sensory input, when we look at how we judge something to be pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, when we look at the thoughts and the emotions that come up, you know, thoughts of our own history, thoughts of our intentions, what we might do in the next minute, when we look at those things through this lens, through this understanding of how the mind conjures self out of all this stuff, it begins to indicate, it begins to kind of like shine a light on the path to freedom that we can follow. So it's not nearly as dry and abstract and mechanical as I was saying. It's quite organic, and it happens very quickly, and it happens moment by moment by moment, you know, as we do that. Thank you, I appreciate your, is that responsive to your question?
Yeah, I think so. So there's, it's a kind of a, it's the word insight. You kind of get these insights by watching what's going on in your head and what kind of emotions are produced. And okay, right. Now I understand why that's a painful thing or for me or whatever.
Yeah.
And then you're because of your awareness of that, you're freer of it than if you don't know why you're getting upset when you smell jasmine or whatever. I mean, that's a, one example.
Yes, just so, you know, those two wisdom factors, you know, when we start to get this understanding of how it is the mind's going about conjuring self and how we, you know, and it's not an intellectual exercise where we sit and kind of, you know, go through our own autobiography. It's something that happens quite automatically and quite in the moment where, you know, like going back to that, to Vedana, second foundation of mindfulness, the mind's judgment, like it, don't care. You know, that's a function that we share with all sentient beings, but it's something that our mind has been doing since, you know, started, we were still in the womb, you know. And so our entire lifetimes have been taken up with the mind trying to sift out, you know, opportunities from threats. Mind seems to be particularly attuned to really locking in on any time that we face a significant threat. Especially any time that we face a significant threat and we're perhaps harmed as well, whether it's verbally, psychologically, or perhaps physically, you know, the mind really remembers that because it doesn't want that thing to happen again. And so that's what that's insight into the first of the two wisdom factors, you know, right view is having instant access to our history, all the things that went into making up who we are in this moment, all the causes and conditions from before birth up to the present moment that gave rise to who we are and how we tend to respond. And then, and one of the things we remember from that is looking back on it, when were the times that I spoke or acted out of strong feelings of aversion or craving, okay, or ignorance, okay? What happened as a result of that speech or action in terms of causing future further suffering to myself or others? What are the consequences from the times when I perhaps saw an unwholesome state of mind arise, but didn't act on it, and instead act in another way that was reflective of a sense of self-knowledge, of kindness, of generosity, right? What were the fruits of that when I spoke or acted based on that state of mind? And this happens again, you know, pretty instantaneously. But right there, the decision point, when we are able to really look at our intentions, not act on the unwholesome ones, act on the wholesome ones. Every time we're able to make that decision, we become freer. And like I say, it's a very organic process. It's just like breathing, you know, but it's the means by which we go about weaving our own future. Yeah. Thanks. Gloria, please. Unmute.
Yeah. Thank you, Tara Lloyd. You kind of answered my question when you responded to Carol. I've got another one churning, but I haven't quite.
hasn't quite formed up yet, huh?
Although, and this, I don't know if this is just trivial, but is there a qualitative difference to responding to a memory arising from formal practice than from everyday activity? I mean, if that memory of the young woman had, if that had occurred while she was walking across campus again, is that qualitatively different than having it arise during a sitting?
I'm not sure I get it. What happened? Well, in terms of learning from past experience, if that's what you're talking about, then and people I know, both women and men, who have been victims of who have endured violent assault, one of the things they usually try to do is avoid being in the same situation again in the future. So there's that. So tell me a little bit more what you mean when you talk about re-experiencing that when they're sitting.
Well, I guess what I'm really after is the best way to allow the memory to become part of your skillful response set.
Yes, yes.
Is that right, to embrace it or to look at it casually and say, oh, you know, to label it like you do when you're sitting? Oh, trauma.
Excellent question. I can answer most authentically based on my own experience. And it was on my first long silent retreat after coming back from Vietnam. And I, for 8 years after coming back, I still had flashbacks, but they only happened when I was sleeping. They happened in the form of nightmares. Mm-hmm. And so I'd wake up frequently. I would be awakened by a memory of being back in the field in South Vietnam and being out on patrol. And being on patrol in an area where we knew that there were enemy fighters and there were mines, this exceedingly dangerous environments. And then there would start to be a firefight, and I'd wake up. You know, that just happened over and over and over and over again. And so on the retreat, instead of it just happening in nightmares when I was sleeping, I began to have those flashbacks while I was sitting. And it was horrible. I thought I was losing my marbles, you know. And so I went and three teachers on that retreat were Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield back in the mid-70s before and each retreat centers were established. And Sharon said, all this happening is catharsis, you know, that you had those experiences when you were 20 years old, when you were seeing, you know, when you're out in the field with the Marines and you were seeing guys getting blown apart by, you know, rockets and stuff. And as a 20-year-old, you didn't have anywhere to put that. You weren't able to endure the psychological injury or the impact of what was going on at the time. And now, she said, what's happening is catharsis, that the mind is going back, remembering those things, you know, part as a self-protective measure so that they don't happen again. But what was hit, but she was saying, to the extent you can do so, and so far as the practice of mindfulness, see if it might be possible to unpack the memory. So, because what happens when there's like a memory of trauma or a flashback, something like that, what happens is that it all comes together in one package, like a big molecule or something, right? When the flashback happens, she said, just it's like a detoxification process, you know, that if it's possible to do so, see if you might be able to disaggregate, like take apart the memory of the facts of the event, what literally happened, you know, what the environment looked like, what action was going on, you know, firefight, you know, danger, hunkering down with it, from the feeling state that was going out at the same time, rage and terror primarily being among them. And she said, if it's possible to do that, then you can say, oh, okay, here's the factual recall of what happened. And here is the emotional response. And then especially if someone around me got hit, you know, or killed or something, and I was a medic, I was supposed to be trying to keep them alive. But if instead of it all being glommed together and being overpowering and overwhelming, if you can break out the facts of the situation from the really incredibly powerful feeling states that accompanied them, then you begin to see that the memory in its totality is not as damaging and pervasively haunting as it otherwise would be. You know, when I was able to start taking that apart a little bit, instead of just feeling horribly strong aversion to the entire memory, I was able to kind of look back at myself in that situation, you know, 8 years earlier, saying, oh, wow, look what I had to go through. You know, so there is that, a sense of compassion, you know, of self-compassion for what was being endured at the time. And once that becomes possible, you begin to become freed of the trauma. So it's like, have a factual recall of the trauma. I sometimes, you know, when I was having the flashbacks, the terror and the rage were happening in the present moment. There's the factual memory, but the terror and rage was in the present moment. And there was a sense, you know, it's happening to me, myself, you know. When this more open, relaxed way of looking at things becomes possible, it begins to drain the memory of its power, of its meaning. So instead of there being a version of the flashback itself or a version of the memory, it becomes possible for the mind to kind of hold it all, you know, in a more kind of loving and accepting way. Same, you know, with the young woman who endured the sexual assault, you know, that what the actual circumstances were, the fact that she was being overwhelmed and violated. And maybe having been able to unpack it a little bit, maybe the smell of a jasmine blossom in future won't be as triggering as it was before she was able to completely unpack the experience. That's, and then in working with combat veterans, that's one of the ways that mindfulness has turned out to be useful for them as well as to me. Is that responsive to your question? Okay, good, thank you. I'll take one more question from James Cole. Yeah, okay.
Hi guys. Please. Hi, Tara Lloyd, thank you. That's a kind of powerful history, and you just remember you telling us about that a few times, and it's powerful every time that I hear it, and it's helpful. So these questions are great. My question is around love and, you know, the non-self. I sometimes wonder about there's something difficult about not loving some people more than others, right? They're dear to us and close to us, a child, a family, a loved, you know, just these people who I think we love them because we see them as entities, you know, as the themselves, you know, we've created a self for them that we love as well. And I wonder how we go about kind of separating ourselves maybe a little bit from that love, or I don't know, but maybe accepting it as real but also not real. I'm not quite sure, because I certainly don't want to not love, you know. Yeah, that's kind of my question trying to get
right. So when I've heard that question asked of another Dharma teacher, the response that I've heard that has resonated with me, and that seems true to me, is that when it becomes possible to experience the world completely from the perspective of not self, okay. That the universe itself becomes love. The nature of being is effortless wisdom and compassion. Okay. There is no self to love another self, but there is love being experienced universally. It becomes experienced more intently with those to whom we are closest, friends, families, loved ones, those whom we hold dear, And to those of us who feel that deeply, there is inevitably, because we're social beings, some sense of craving and clinging, of really, you know, holding that person dear, not wanting them to be harmed, not wanting to lose them, okay, not wanting to die ourselves and no longer be in contact with them, right? And at some point, when we become aware that it is in fact this creation of self, it's like there's a pretty well-known book out there on death and dying. It says, "Who dies? You know, who is it that's lost?" One of my teachers, Ajahn Amaro, who's the head of a monastery in England now, he was riding once in a car with his own teacher, Ajahn Sumedho, pretty highly realized being by most accounts. They're driving from Los Angeles up north to a monastery in Northern California that Amaro was the head of at the time. And they were driving from LA, where they had just been with Sumedho's mother and she was dying. And as they were driving along, Amaro looked over and saw that Sumedho was crying. And again, this is one of these people who is regarded to more or less live in this state of a continuous understanding of the universe being by nature one of wisdom and compassion when self has fallen away. And he looks over and he sees Sumedho crying. He says, "Why are you crying?" And Sumedho says, "My mom died." It's our nature, you know. And it doesn't mean that, you know, we're still stuck at some level or other. It's like it is our nature to love. It's easiest to love, by and large, those who are closest to us, friends, family, ones we hold dear. And yet at the same time, when it's possible to let go of the self, it doesn't mean there isn't any more love. It means in some ways, like Amaro says, in some ways that's all there is. Because the artificial distinction between self and other has vanished.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, James. I appreciate the question. I know we've run a little over. Thanks for hanging in there, everybody. Please stay safe and have a good week, and see you again soon.
Thank you. Yeah.
Thank you, Tara Lloyd.
Thank you.
Glad you're here.